Thanks tuned to yesterday with an hour of Collection Curios. I'm your host, Mark Lavelier. The old-time radio collection at WRPO Public Media, known as the Ellen Robinson Memorial Library, contains tens of thousands of broadcasts on reel-to-reel tape. There's a vast archive of the big-name shows from radio's golden age, but among the shelves are series with very few surviving episodes, one-off programs, underheard tapes, and long-considered to be rare broadcasts. In this hour, we get the reel spinning with programs not yet heard on our show, or at the very least, on the air in a very long time. There is a lot of mystery in this hour with The Word Detective and an episode of The Big Guy, bookended with a very unique idea from radio's distant past. At a time when there was not a lot of crime programs on the air, the show Suspicion devised a way to keep people listening from week to week by not actually finishing the show. The 15-minute program would present a case and give the solution the following week, which is what we'll do in this hour as well, so remember the details and see if you can solve the case in the play Double Cross, a syndicated episode from 1935.
What made me first suspect Joe was that he knew more than an innocent person should have known.
I suspected Irene the moment I heard the fireman's testimony.
It was the apparently unimportant fact that Grace had...
I suspected the postman after
Listen to radio's newest, most interesting and thrilling program, Suspicion. And now, Suspicion. Somewhere in the drama about to be presented is a seemingly unimportant fact, a hidden clue that first casts suspicion on the ultimate culprit. Listen carefully to this thrilling series. Test your powers of observation and deduction and find the hidden clue. It may be a single line, a sound, perhaps a complete scene. All names and characters depicted in this story are fictitious. Any resemblance to persons living or dead is entirely coincidental. And now, the Double Cross. Late one evening in June, a powerful motorboat, showing no lights, enters the harbor of a city on the Pacific coast, proceeds cautiously toward an abandoned wharf. Standing next to the helmsman, an attractive woman in her middle 20s talks in guarded tones to a slim, nervous man sitting in the after section of the cabin.
Got everything straight, Eddie?
Yeah, sure. Five tins for Jack, five for Maisie. I take five and five for you.
Okay.
You know, Rose, I kind of think the boss has gone nuts. We've been lucky bringing in $20,000 loads of dope, but 50 grand? That's a big order. Dangerous.
Why don't you find the big boss and tell him he's wrong?
Honey, if I knew who the brain really was, I'd be getting more money for my work.
You better take the dough you're getting and shut up.
Maybe. Say, do you know the brain, Rose?
No, who does? He's smart, not letting anyone know him. But I've been told he's okay if you play ball. But if you don't...
Yeah, I get the general idea. Well, there's the signal.
Cut out on the speed, Pete. We're coming in.
Okay. Sure hope them guys is better with the boat hook than they was the last time.
Ah, quit beefing.
Shut up, both of you. There's a cop hanging around and he hears you.
If a cop sticks his nose in, he'll get a snoop full of lead. Cops ain't bulletproof.
That mug takes off more varnish than last time, I'll knock his block off.
Sure, just like that. Hi, Jack. Snap into it, Eddie. Keep your shirt on. Here's a bundle of five.
Hands up, the whole lot of you. Get your hands up, miss.
Take this, Cooper. Here's the rest of the dope. Now let's get going.
Boys, Tim Hogan's going to live. He isn't able to tell much, but he says there were at least five people on the wharf last night.
Dope smugglers, eh, Chief?
Right. A small gang, but one with a real brain detecting it. The federal men have been after it for some time, but last night they shot up one of our men, and that brings us into the case. We'll work with the feds, of course, but don't forget Tim Hogan.
How about throwing out a net and grilling everyone?
No, not this time, George. The federals believe we're up against a mob that handles nothing but dope. We'll have to rely on stool pigeons and undercover work for a lead.
But most of our regular stoolies are known,
Chief. Well, get some petty crooks, then, and... Hello?
Miss Nellie Jones is here, sir.
Send her in. You boys remember Nellie, don't you?
Sure. Has she been shoplifting again?
I haven't heard anything against her.
Hello, boys.
Hello, Nellie. What can we do for you?
How's Tim Hogan?
Well, the doc says he'll be all right in a couple of months. Why?
Oh, quit giving me the fishy eye, Chief. I've been on the level for the last 6 months.
Well,
see?
You haven't had any complaints against you, Nellie.
Well, you would have if it wasn't for Tim. I ain't naming the store, see, but I tried my hand again, and I guess I was out of practice too long, because Tim Hogan seen me. Instead of arresting me, he fixed it up with a store manager, and, well, Tim's the right guy, see?
What's your deal, Nellie?
Say, you guys are awful slow on the upbeat.
Okay, Nellie. But you know what often happens to stool pigeons. We're up against a tougher gang than usual. But if you want to take the chance, we won't forget, Nellie. But remember, we're trusting you. One slip and...
How about that?
Did you bring the junk with you?
Maybe.
Here's 20 bucks. 4 or 5 spots, just like you said.
Aren't you hitting the needle pretty hard?
That's my business, see?
Keep your shirt on, sister. What's your racket?
Say...
You wouldn't be alive if you'd used all the cocaine I sold you 2 days ago.
Well, a couple of friends, friends wanted some, and
so you sold to them, eh?
Oh, ain't nothing wrong in that, is there?
Don't get frightened, honey. Have you got lots of friends?
Yeah, but I'm not telling you.
You play ball with me, honey, and maybe I can get you a job peddling junk. How about it?
Sounds okay by me.
Be at the address on this card at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. That's one thing, baby. Behave yourself or you'll wind up in the bay, floating face down.
Hello?
Nothing new today, Chief, but I think I've gotten as close to the gang as possible.
Yes?
Nobody knows who brings the junk in or who's the brain.
Are you sure?
Yeah, looks like we're stymied.
Well, the only thing to do is keep trying. How are you fixed for money?
Well, I need 200 as soon as I can get it.
Right, we'll mail it tonight. Well, there's nothing to do but play along with her, I guess. Or else raid the apartment on Main Street and try to sweat the truth out of the big peddlers.
Maybe we'd better string with Nellie. The man we've had tailing her for the last 6 weeks gives her a clean bill, and her story's the same as our man's, Billy Peston's. He's worked his way up as Hal Richards to the top of the dope peddlers, too.
Well, then keep your fingers crossed for a decent break soon, George.
Late the following afternoon.
Hello?
We got 5 tins of cocaine today, Chief. The package was left in the hall outside the apartment.
What time?
Well, between 10:30 and noon. I wasn't there when they found it.
Anything else? Did you get the money okay?
Yeah. One of the fellas has asked me out to dinner tonight and then to a party.
Who?
Hal Richards.
Okay. Keep your eyes open. You know where to get in touch with me.
What's up, Chief?
George, suppose that Nellie is the brain of the gang we're after. Tim Hogan says there was a woman at the dock when he was shot up. I'm wondering if she's the brain and knows that Billy Peston is Hal Richards.
Probably he spotted her as the brain and...
More likely, she's the brain and has learned that Hal Richards is a cop. Hello?
This is Smokey Joe, Chief.
Oh, hello, Smokey. How's business?
I got some news to shop.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, if it does you good, give me 50 bucks. If it don't, then you don't owe me nothing.
Well, what is the news? I'll pay if it's good.
Okie doke. Now get this straight. I overheard two guys talking, see? One of them tells the other that a boatload of dope is going to be brought in tonight and landed at the old swimming club. You got that?
Yeah, old swimming club at the foot of Catalina Street, eh? What time?
Now, I didn't ask, Chief. But don't forget the 50 smackers if the tip's okay. So long.
Wait a minute, Smokey. Hello. Hello. I guess that was all I knew, George. But it's plenty. Get 20 of our best shots. Phone the Bay Patrol boat. We'll give those smugglers a real welcome home party.
Boys are all set, Chief.
We'll wait till the shipment has been transferred to the dock. Is the police boat standing by on the other side?
Yeah. It'll close in when you give the signal.
Good work, George. Wait till that mug has both feet on the dock. Watch it. There they are now.
We have you covered on all sides, boys. Put them up.
Try that, Copper!
Let him have it, George.
Right.
Well, come out of the shadows then, you guys, and with your hands up, quick.
No use talking to them, Copper. I took a dive for the floor, or I wouldn't be talking.
Where are these narcotics going?
I don't know.
Where are you taking it?
I tell you, I don't know. Oh, all right. I suppose the jig is up. We bring it in and run an ad in the newspaper and...
What kind of an ad?
Oh, in the sob columns. Then we get a letter from the brain saying how he's to deliver. A couple of days later, we get our money.
Sounds screwy to me, Chief. How come you didn't double-cross the brain, sister?
Wake up floating face down in the bay? It'll be a sap all your life, copper. But as for who the boss of this racket is, you got me, pal.
20 minutes later, while questioning Rose Blair at the police station...
It won't get you anywhere, Rose, saying you don't know the brain behind the narcotic ring. If you turn state's evidence... Hello?
It's me, Chief, Billy Peston. I'm at 219 and a half Longfelt Drive. I just killed the brain behind the narcotic smuggling gang.
Good. We'll be right over. Nice going, Billy. Nice going. Where is he?
He? It was a she.
What?
Yeah, a woman. Come along, I'll show you. I thought there was something unusual in this racket all along. Well, there she is.
Well, what do you know about that, George? Nellie Jones.
You said there was something screwy about her turning stool pigeon, Chief.
How did it happen, Billy?
Well, I asked her up here for dinner in order to get her away from the others. I had a hunch she was the brain. And after we got here, she asked for a glass of water, and like a sucker, I went into the kitchen to get it.
And she started shooting as you came back, eh?
Yeah, that's right. Had her gun out and ready. She fired a couple of times before I got her.
Well, any one of your shots would have killed her, Peston. She must have been dead before she hit that floor.
Well, it looks like we've rounded up the whole gang tonight.
Yeah. She kept her gun in the coat pocket, George.
Yeah?
Look, let's get out of here, will you? I feel kind of... Well, you know how it is.
Sure we do, Billy.
Yeah, I should think you would feel nervous. After murdering this woman, what? Keep your hands still, Peston.
What, are you crazy?
Peston, you're under arrest for the murder of Nellie Jones.
Good Lord, man,
Chief,
you don't...
You remember the description Rose Blair and Eddie gave?
They never saw me. They didn't know I was the head of...
They didn't know you were the brain of the racket, eh? Huh. I was hoping you'd get rattled enough to make a slip like that. I feel sorry for you, pal. It may hang you.
The following conversation took place immediately after Billy Preston had been booked for the murder of Nellie Jones.
Yes, Chief. Preston knew that criminals make mistakes, and clever though he was, he thought he might have made one. It was fear that trapped him.
Not only fear, George. It was you. I must have been blind not to have noticed...
Ladies and gentlemen, did you discover the hidden clue that caused George Phillips to suspect Billy Peston as the murderer of Nellie Jones and the brain of the narcotic smuggling ring? If you did, write to this station and tell us the hidden clue you found. And to check your power of observation and deduction, listen for the correct hidden clue in this story the next time we present... Suspicion.
At the end of this hour, we'll bring you the solution to that first episode of Suspicion from 1935. Of the 39 episodes that were made, I couldn't find any broadcasts listed in any major newspaper radio schedules of the time, leading me to believe that this could have been sent to smaller stations, with its format not really grabbing audiences in any real way. And I may have solved that mystery. It took a week for the story to end. And we will hear it later in this hour of Collection Curios on Tuned to Yesterday by Mark Levonier. Now on to an episode of a program that actually inspired the Collection Curios series in the first place, called The Big Guy. Only a few broadcasts of this lighthearted detective show survived from its NBC run from early May to late October of 1950, heard on the East Coast Sunday evenings at 5, and elsewhere earlier, on the air at the same time as one of the best-remembered mystery shows, at that point broadcasting for almost two decades, The Shadow. The Big Guy follows the adventures of the large detective Joshua Sharp, played by Henry Calvin, who was large in stature himself and would be best known several years after this radio run in the role of Sergeant Demetrio Lopez Garcia on television's Zorro. While Henry Calvin may have been in uncredited roles on radio up to this point, this was his first time as leading man on the air, so far as I can tell. Here's an episode of The Big Guy from August 27, 1950 on NBC.
Tell us again,
Daddy. Tell us again.
Oh, no, not again.
Please, Daddy, how tall are you?
Tell us how tall.
I'm 20 foot 5 in my stocking feet.
How big are your shoes?
What size do you wear?
Size 902 in a triple Z.
That's our daddy,
the big guy.
NBC presents The Big Guy, another in the series of adventures of a very unusual detective, Joshua Sharp. Joshua Sharp works for his clients on a strictly cash basis to provide for the needs of his nearest and dearest, Josh Jr. and his daughter, Debbie. To these two, Sharp is both father and mother. To his clients, he is a good detective. To Josh and Debbie, he's the friendly magician, the fabulous hero, the giant among giants, The Big Guy. Tonight's adventure with the big guy, the case of the villainous friend.
A man alone, trying to bring up a pair of youngsters, runs into a lot of unexpected problems. One of my most unexpected was a sudden shortage of bedtime stories. After all, you can read Grimm's fairy tales only a few hundred times before the kids begin to tire of them. And that goes for Hans Christian Andersen and all the rest of the Once Upon a Timers. I'd reached that point with Josh and Debbie, and they were getting so bored with witches and sleeping beauties that finally, for all our sakes, I tried tapping a new source. I bought a copy of Tales from Shakespeare. It was an immediate hit. In fact, it was too big a hit. That first night, I read The Tempest and Two Gentlemen from Verona, and still they didn't want me to stop.
What's the next one, Daddy?
Well, we'll let the next one wait, baby. You and Debbie have to go to sleep.
But what's the name of it? Just the name of it?
It's the tragedy of Othello. Now, you just close your eyes and...
Oh, what about him, Daddy? Yes, Daddy, who was he?
Well, he was a man, Josh.
Oh, and what was the tragedy?
Well, he was married to a woman named Desdemona who loved him very much.
Is that a tragedy?
No. The tragedy came about because he had a friend named Iago.
Yes?
And Iago came to Othello and told him that Desdemona didn't love him at all. He said she loved somebody else.
He was bad, wasn't he, Daddy?
Oh, very.
And what happens next?
Well, next he... Next, a couple of shrewd articles who are trying to worm another story out of their hard-working father give him a kiss and say goodnight. And it was a good night under my roof. But elsewhere, things were happening that were fated finally to intrude on my routine and make a shambles of it. The center of these events was a boy named Frank Gollard. I'd snagged the lad in question 2 years ago, after he'd assisted in the armed robbery of a filling station and committed assault and battery, resisting arrest. My action in the matter came as part of my contract with the Mutual Indemnity Insurance Company, and I had been in the courtroom the day the judge passed a 10-year sentence on Frank Gollard. And then, the same evening, while I was telling Josh and Debbie about Othello, inside the drab gray walls of the upstate penitentiary...
Wife lately, Frank.
Yeah, I got a letter from Lila last week. Well, let's turn in, Hap. What do you say?
Yeah, sure, kid. In a minute. Lila. Oh, that's a pretty name.
Hap.
Huh?
How come you ask me that?
Oh, I heard you tossing around last night. I knew you wasn't sleeping. And I've been thinking about all the guys in this place who got somebody waiting for them and wondering where all them somebodies are tonight. Wondering who she's dancing with and wondering who she's drinking with. Wonder who's the kissing?
Shut up.
Oh, kid.
I told you once, Hap.
I was only wondering.
She's a clean kid. Clean and sweet and straight.
Sure. There's a few good wrens in the world. Maybe you got yourself one of them. But you couldn't expect me to guess that now, could you, Frank? Man never knows about a thing like that. Man just never knows.
Good night, Hap.
You ain't sore on me, are you, Frank?
I said good night.
I don't want you to be sore on me, you hear? You hear me, Frank?
Okay, I'm not sore at you. Okay, Hap.
Good night, baby.
Hap was his cellmate, and Hap was his friend. Big, slow, paternal Hap McLean. In for life. And not a man to talk much about the way he was to spend the rest of his natural days. It was mutual friendship, and the two found a degree of peace in each other's companionship. It was a peace, however, that was ripped to shreds with the suddenness of a thunderclap one hot night in early August. Hap had smuggled a newspaper from the prison library into the cell, and young Gollard was lying on his bunk, turning the pages.
Hey, Hap.
What's the matter? What's eating you, Frank?
Hey, listen to this. What cute lovely whose maid is doing a 10-year stretch for armed robbery is now seeing the town inside out with more than one slick-haired Romeo. Even while I was on trial, she was rocking
me. No, kid, take it.
She was. While I took the ride to this pile of stinking stone, while I prayed for every night, she was selling me out. Midnight to morning, night after night, all the way down the line. Shut up!
Listen to me, will you, Frank? Listen to happenings, oh, baby.
I can't take it.
But he had no choice about taking it. With his friend Hap's help, he calmed down and went on with the monotonous routine of his daily life behind the walls of the prison. And then, late one night, weeks later, in the cell he shared with Hap McLean, he found that he didn't have to take it anymore.
Frank, hey, kid, wake up and listen. Listen, old Hap, and listen good. You got to get out of here.
What's that?
You're eating yourself alive. You got to move loose from this place.
Oh, but I can't. I can't. I'm not up for parole.
Forget the parole, baby. Hap's got it all fixed fine.
You got it fixed?
Yeah. Take a look, kid.
Where'd you get the gun?
Out of the arsenal, baby. It took me 3 months and a lot of doing, but I got it. And the trustee, the one in the laundry office, he's going to leave the laundry door unlocked for 20 minutes tomorrow night. There'll be a truck just outside.
How did you do this, Hap?
Oh, look, I've been in this can 12 years. There are ways, baby. There are always ways.
You come with me?
No, I got nothing with the outside world, kid. Hap will rest easy right here. You go on out. You can still hate, and that means you can still live. Enjoy yourself. And don't get yourself snagged, baby.
It was at 11 o'clock the next night that the guard changed. 2 minutes before this chosen hour, Hap McLean stood crucial guard for the appearance of any official, and the boy prepared for his venture.
Well, you make for
her apartment.
You figure Lila'll show?
I'll wait till she does.
What, and get nabbed off waiting? Forget it. Now look, I'll get the grapevine and let her know that you're coming and tell her to stand by for you. There it is. 11 o'clock, kid.
Okay.
Play it cagey now, baby. Hap won't be around to look out for you.
There's no point in saying thank you, huh, Hap?
Go on, you punk. I'll brain you.
The boy was halfway across the prison yard when...
Stop! Stop where you are!
And the shaft of a giant searchlight struck him like the lunge of an angry lion. Darting out of its glare, he took cover behind an angle of the wall.
Come out in the open! Come out with your hands up!
The boy fired at the guard on the watchtower. He made a dash for the laundry building and found the door unlocked as scheduled. The truck roared along the back roads on the all-night drive to the city while the state was springing into action to retake Frank Gollard. Retake him, dead or alive. Next morning, when I walked into my place of business, my own personal private eye, Risky Skinner, was waiting for me, as usual. But today, Risky wasn't alone. A young city cop, Tom Saunders by name, had dropped in to tell me about the Gollard escape. He was little more than a rookie, this cop. Green, but enterprising.
So, knowing you were the man who put the finger on him in the first place 2 years ago, Sharp, it occurred to a few of the boys at precinct headquarters that you might have ideas about retaking Frank Gollard.
They figure you dig up a few angles about the punk that could be maybe useful, Commander.
I'll be glad to do all I can. Tell me, how much action is underway now?
Well, the state's being dragged from end to end. Even the Coast Guard's been alerted on this one.
Any results yet?
So far, we've drawn a goose egg.
Just a second.
Yeah.
Sharp speaking.
This is Lila Goddard, Mr. Sharp.
What?
Frank Gollard's wife.
Where are you?
I'm not calling from home, Mr. Sharp. I'm afraid to go there.
Why?
I'll tell you why. I got a call last night from the grapevine at Goldville Prison.
Yeah?
Frank is on his way to my place.
On the way to his own home? Hello. Hello, Mrs. Gollard. Mrs. Gollard. Hello. Hello. The wire was dead, but the news had been sensational. Leaving Risky to try to check back on the call, I found Mrs. Gollard's address in the city listings, latched onto Patrolman Saunders, and headed for Gollard's home. By 25 of 10, we were in his apartment. I was at the window and Saunders by the door.
Hey, Sharp.
Okay, I see him.
He's coming in.
Great. Get ready for business.
Yeah, well, let's wait for him in the hall, huh?
All right. Easy with that door, Saunders.
Yes. Here he comes.
Let him get to the first landing. And for Pete's sake, stop shaking.
There he is. He's carrying a gun.
Hey, Saunders. No, wait! But I was too late. The green rookie, firing in panic, missed, and Frank Gollard went crashing back down the stairs, through the door, and out into the street. I didn't have to be told that once loose, Gollard would head for his wife. After all, Lila had tipped me off, and he probably knew that she was the only person on earth who had been wise to his whereabouts. The immediate deal, therefore, was to contact her without delay. It was just about this time there came a knock on the door of Warden Jameson's office at the state penitentiary, and a cell block guard by the name of Spears walked in with the announcement that somebody wanted to talk to the warden.
Who is it, Spears?
It's prisoner from cell block A. He yammered till I went to see what was wrong.
Yes, Spears?
Well, then he told me he could retake Gollard for us, nothing flat.
And I can, Warden. Honest, so help me now. I'm not kidding. I know exactly what I'm talking
about. I told you to wait outside.
All right, Spears. All right, I'll talk to him.
Okay, Warden.
You say you can recapture Frank Gollard?
And be back before morning.
Who are you?
Number 5,200.
I mean your name.
Oh, my name is Hap McLean.
I presume, McLean, that you can only perform this remarkable feat if you allow to be left out of the prison alone.
Who wants a loan? Send Spears with me with a gun, a dozen guns. Who cares? Now, look, I'm only trying to do the right thing here, Mr. Warden. That's all I'm interested in.
I see. All right. We'll send Spears with you.
And you won't regret it, I'll tell you what.
And I'm telling you something, McLean. If you succeed in this mission, I'll see what can be done to secure you a full and complete pardon.
No, you mean it.
Don't you think you deserve it?
Well, I guess I did figure something like that.
Yeah, I imagined you did, McLean. Spears.
Yes, sir.
You'll take McLean into the city. Let him do exactly as he thinks best.
So, Hap McLean, informer and temporary public hero, passed out of the prison walls on his errand of black treachery. Meanwhile, we were still ransacking the city for Lila, and as it turned out, Frank Gollard was doing the same. In the phone booth of a hole-in-the-wall cigar store on a side street.
She must be at her summer cottage at Riverview. Yeah, that's it. That's probably where she's hiding out.
Number, please.
Give me Riverview 534.
Riverview 534. Thank you, sir.
Hello?
Is this you, Lila?
Oh, Frank. How are you, Frank, honey?
I'm fine.
What's happening, Frank?
I'm looking for you, Lila. Why did you go up to Riverview to sleep, Lila?
What's the matter, Frank?
Matter? Nothing. I just wanted to see you.
Where are you? I'll come right into the city.
Stay where you are. I'll come to you.
All right, sweetheart. You remember how to get here?
Yeah, I remember. You were alone, Lila?
Yes. A girlfriend was staying with me up until last night, but she had to get back to town. Oh, honey, I wish we could be together. I wish we never had to leave here.
Stay where you are till I get there, baby. Maybe you never will.
Feeling for the gun butt in his pocket, Frank Gollard ducked out onto the sidewalk and started the torturous journey toward his final, long-sought vengeance. Later in the afternoon, back at the office, Saunders and I were checking the shortwave reports.
You know, it baffles me a little, Sharp.
What does?
Gollard's wife turning him in.
Why? She's a gunman's doll, isn't she?
No, not quite. Anyway, she's not running true to form.
Why not?
A word around has been that she's almost arranged for his parole. Strange, huh?
Yeah, very.
Commander!
Yeah, Risky?
Well, a little luck at last.
Well, that we can use.
I think I found out where Mrs. Gollard phoned you from.
Yeah?
But, well, I'm afraid it won't help any. It seems she rang up from a phone booth.
Phone booth, huh? Where?
In a place called Banner's Tavern over on Tyne Street, near the river. You know it? I said, do you know it, Commander?
Huh? Oh, yeah, I know it. Risky.
Yeah, Commander?
Go get me a cap and a sweater.
Huh? A cap and a sweater. What do you want them for?
To wear. I'm going to Banner's Tavern, Risky, and I want to look like one of the boys. Banner's Tavern, at the foot of a wharf on the river, had never been what might be called a pride to the community. And tonight was no exception. The clientele I saw at once was entirely male, except for one blonde cutie who sat alone over a glass of beer, a bright red scar of a smile on her hard face.
Well, what are you looking at?
Well, what do you think, honey?
Beat it. I got a boyfriend coming.
Yeah? From where?
That would be telling.
Well, how's about a little drink till he shows?
Well, I'll...
Go ahead. What'll you have?
How about a gin and water?
Why not? What's your name, beautiful?
Esther.
That's all?
Esther Moody.
Moody?
Mm-hmm.
Esther Moody? Well, you ain't the doll used to kick around with Hap McLean.
You know Hap?
Like that. We used to operate together in North Jersey.
Well, what do you know?
How's he doing these days?
He's in stir. Didn't you know that?
For how long?
Hard to say right now. Some kind of caper in the works.
Yeah?
I've been trying to figure it out all night.
What's the lowdown?
Well, lean over here.
Yeah.
About 11 o'clock last night, Hap sent me the word over the grapevine.
Uh-huh.
And he tells me to call up a certain private eye this morning, announce myself as Mrs. Gollard, and say that Frank is on his way to his wife's flat. What do you think?
What do you think?
I think I trusted you mighty fast, handsome. How about that little drink?
How about better?
Better?
How about a little pinch?
What?
Roused up, lady. I'm the private eye you handed that runaround to this morning. I got her to headquarters, not, however, without a set of fingernail marks down my cheek, and walked in on a bit of exciting news. It seemed a postal clerk at a place called Riverview had phoned in, giving Lila Gollard's whereabouts. The address, 21 Canton Lane. At which street number, Frank Gollard had just arrived.
strange over the phone. I don't understand. What have I done?
You really want me to tell you, Lila? You called the cops and told them where they could pick me up.
I did, Frank?
Yeah, you.
Frank! Frank, how could I? I didn't even know you'd broken out.
McLean got word to you at the apartment last night and told you where I'd be.
But I wasn't there. I wasn't even there.
Ah, that's an easy out. You turn me in and then you run for the tall timber.
Frank. Frank, do you honestly believe I'd do that?
I know you did it, you hypocritical swine.
Oh, darling. Darling.
Yeah?
Hello, kid.
Hep.
I lammed out myself, kid. I figured you needed somebody to look after you. You done business yet?
Not all of it. But I'm right here at home base.
Yeah, so I figured.
Hep?
Yeah, baby.
You contacted my wife last night, didn't you?
Well, sure. Sure thing. Why do you ask?
I won't ask again. I gotta hang up now.
Well, just a second, Frank. I'm in the alley behind Banner's Tavern on the side by the river. You know where that is?
Yeah, sure.
Well, then beat it down to see me as soon as you can. I got a pal along who's going to see you safe out of the States on a strictly credit basis. Okay?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a million. I'll see you, pal. You cheap, lying, rotten, deceitful tramp.
Oh, no. No, Frank, no. It's not a gun.
Shut up. This is beyond begging and no place for talk. If you've got prayers to say, say them. There won't be any time later.
I won't need time for prayers, Frank. I'd die before I hurt you. I don't mind losing my life, Frank. All I regret is I'll never see you again. Never. Never.
It was at that moment that Risky and I drove up in front of 21 Canton Lane and heard the shots as we ran up the path to the house.
That was it, Commander?
Yeah. Gollard. Gollard, you blasted fool.
What did you do, you crazy punk?
I just killed a liar, a stoolie, and a cheat. Let's go now without questions, huh?
First, there's got to be a few answers given, boy.
Such as?
Such as, did you know this cheat here had just about arranged to get you paroled at the next meeting of the board?
You're lying.
Too bad for your peace of mind, I'm not. Not when I said that, nor when I say this. Your wife didn't call me and inform on you today, Gollard.
She did, she did.
No, she didn't. The call I got came from a woman named Esther Moody, who made it to help weave this net you're caught in.
Moody? Esther Moody? Who's that? What's she got to do with me?
She's got nothing to do with you. But I think maybe her boyfriend has.
A boyfriend?
A guy by the name of Hap McLean. For a moment, he stared at me like a wounded animal, and then his eyes closed slowly. He shook his head wearily, as if to come out of a sick dizziness, and neither Riskin nor I caught the movement of his hand as he blasted the globe dangling from the ceiling, plunging us into blind blackness as he crashed out through the window. Nearer dawn, in the alley behind Banner's Tavern.
It's getting chilly waiting here, McLean. Where's your boy?
Easy, Spears. Take it easy. He's on his way to us.
Yeah.
There he comes.
You sure it's him?
Can't you see, Flathead? Hey, give me a gun. Let me take him in.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Now duck behind the lamppost so we don't see you too soon.
Hap!
Here I am, kid. How you making it, huh?
I killed her, Hap.
Yeah, sure. That's what you had to do. Come on. We'll go in Banners and have a few snorts. That'll set you up right, huh?
Hey, Hap.
Yeah.
Where's the pal who was going to help me lamb out of the States?
Well, he had to go, Frank. He'll be back.
I figured he was back now. That's him behind the lamppost, ain't it, Hap? I gotta get him, too.
Kid.
Help me.
Kid, how
help
much
me.
Blood do you want on your hands, baby?
Just a little more. Just a little more, you greasy, crummy stool pigeon.
Thank you. Pap McLean took a look into the empty, cold eyes of the boy and suddenly bolted down the alley. At the corner, McLean swung abruptly and fired. The bullet hit, and he waited for Frank Gollard to go down, but he waited in vain. The boy came toward him, head lowered, staggering.
Baby, baby, don't be sore on me. I don't want you sore on me, Frank.
As he spoke, McLean fired again and found himself with an empty gun in his hand. And he blinked unbelievingly as the boy swayed with the anguish of the shots, and then steadily he plowed forward. Half crazy with fear, McLean stumbled into the darkness until he came to World's End at the edge of the wharf behind the tavern.
Oh, baby, oh, Frank, you gotta listen to your hap. You gotta listen to your happy. You can't be sore on me, baby. I'm for you, honest. Oh, don't shoot, kid. Let's talk it out there.
Frank Gollard, looking like a child asleep, was dead, stretched out on the rotten planking of the wharf when we found him. Josh and Debbie were in bed when I climbed the stairs to our flat, and knowing nothing of what was going on inside of me, they clamored for the next story in the book. The next story was Othello. And as I read the tale of the tragic deaths of Desdemona and Othello and the final undoing of Iago, I shuddered with a kind of recognition. At the end of the narrative, there was silence. Then...
And Othello killed himself, too?
Yes, baby.
Gee, I don't see why he had to die. He didn't know what he was doing. It was all Iago's fault, wasn't it, Daddy?
Yes. Yes, essentially, it was Iago's fault.
Then why didn't he just explain and go on living?
Maybe he didn't want to, honey.
Oh, you mean because he'd lost Desdemona? Is that it?
Well, that's part of it.
Well, what's the other part, Daddy?
Don't you know?
You mean he'd lost Iago, too?
Yes, baby. You get the point. He'd also lost his friend.
Joshua Sharp, detective, works for his clients on a strictly cash basis to provide for the needs of his nearest and dearest, Josh Jr. and Debbie. To them, he's the friendly magician, the fabulous hero, the giant among giants, the big guy.
The Big Guy, from the 27th of August, 1950, on NBC. You are listening to an hour of Collection Curios on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark Lefonier. Before we get to the solution of Double Cross from earlier on the series Suspicion, let's hear a unique radio moment from a man beloved as the world's greatest detective, Sherlock Holmes. Actor Basil Rathbone, in the years after he retired the deerstalker cap, cloak, and calabash pipe in the movies and on the air, would still occasionally wink at the role he was most famous for in guest appearances and commercial work. In 1959, he recorded 5 episodes of Word Detective for the Underwood Typewriter Company, in the same year that company was bought out by a rival, maybe explaining some of the marketing dollars spent on Rathbone. Here's an episode from the series.
2,000 years ago, in the crowded marketplace of an ancient North African city, the soldiers of Caesar Augustus sampled an exotic new delicacy from the East. This was the start of a chain of events which led to a treat on our tables. And a word in our dictionaries. You'll hear more of that word on this edition of Word Detective, prepared as an educational service of this station in cooperation with the Underwood Corporation, for more than 60 years a leader in the field of typewriters and business machines. During the years when the sprawling Roman Empire fanned out to include most of North Africa, the Emperor Caesar Augustus signed an imperial edict which elevated a bustling Mediterranean seaport called Tangier to the status of a free city. We know this ancient Moorish metropolis as Tangier. In Caesar's time, it was a rich and cultured metropolis, an important stop on Arab trade routes from the Far East. The gate of the city which led to the produce-packed stalls of the marketplace gave local citizens access to a selection of the most exotic wares in the world. Spices from Ceylon, steel from Damascus, and at some point during Tangier's long history, nobody quite knows when, the squatting marketplace Moors added to their display a strange but delicious new fruit, delivered to the West African port by Arab caravans from the Malay archipelago half a world away. Within a short time after the fruit from the East was first put on sale in the marketplace, it was not only being served on West African tables, but also being cultivated in thick West African groves. When Caesar's foreign-based GIs visited the Tangier marketplace, this same cycle started all over again. They came, they saw, they tasted, and conquered by the experience, started their own flourishing fruit groves back home in Italy. Tucked into the toe of a Christmas stocking or adding color to the fruit centerpiece of a Thanksgiving table, we're apt to think of the fruit now as being all American. But when we add it to our shopping lists, we still refer to it as if we were ordering not from a neighborhood grocery store, but from the honey-scented stalls of a crowded North African marketplace. Maybe you know now the word which all this is leading up to. I'll type it out for you right now on my Underwood typewriter, the only typewriter with the golden touch. The word is tangerine, meaning literally a native of Tangier. This red-tinged member of the orange family, distinguished by its easily detached rind, actually originated somewhere in tropical Asia. We know it as a tangerine because 2,000 years ago, a group of African-based Roman soldiers went shopping in a Moorish market for souvenirs for the folks back home. On tomorrow's edition of Word Detective, we're off to the races in search of not just one word history, but a whole bundle of them. Now don't go away. I'll be back in a moment.
A syndicated broadcast from 1959 of radio's Word Detective. And now, before we close this hour, we'll revisit Suspicion from 1935, where we heard Episode 1. And as the show promised, here's the solution to the mystery presented at the beginning of Episode 2.
In Double Cross, the story we presented last time, do you remember this scene? The police chief and George Phillips have arrived at a house on Longfelt Drive in answer to Billy Peston's phone call that he had killed the brains of the smuggling ring. Billy Peston is recounting the gun battle.
Yes, for a glass of water, and like a sucker, I went into the kitchen to get it.
And she started shooting as you came back, eh?
Yeah. Had her gun out and ready. She fired a couple of times before I got her.
Any one of your shots would have killed her, Peston. She must have been dead before she hit that floor.
Well, looks as if we'd rounded up the whole gang tonight.
Yeah. She kept her gun in her coat pocket, George.
Yeah.
Nellie Jones' gun, ladies and gentlemen, was in her pocket. Yet she was killed instantly. Obviously, Billy Peston was lying about her shooting at him. He had killed her in cold blood.
The solution to Double Cross from 1935's Suspicion on Tuned to Yesterday. And in keeping with our theme of crime and mystery, we do have enough time for a cut-down broadcast of 5-Minute Mysteries from June 24th, 1948.
Another 5-Minute Mystery. And so Johnny Raymond and his organ bring to a close the first program of his new radio series. This is your announcer, James Van Dorn, saying good night to you all.
Gentlemen, please. Quiet. That's better. Now, Mr. Horton, you're the director of this show. Would you tell me in your own words exactly what happened when Van Dorn died?
Well, Inspector, it was toward the end of the program. Van Dorn reached for the button to put the studio off the air, and then he just gasped and fell to the floor.
I see. Where were the rest of you when this happened?
Well, Taylor and I were in the control room, and Johnny Raymond was at the organ.
Are you Taylor?
That's right. I'm the studio engineer.
Did you notice anything peculiar during the program?
No, sir. I was in the control room most of the time.
Most of the time?
Well, except for the few minutes when I went into the studio to check the equipment just before going on the air.
You noticed nothing out of the ordinary?
No, sir.
How about you, Raymond?
Well, I was at the organ singing during the whole show.
And you didn't see anything either?
No. Mr. Van Dorn just pushed the button and then collapsed.
Let's take a look at this button. Yeah. Which one was it, Mr. Raymond?
Well, I wouldn't know. kind of new around here.
It's this black one here, Inspector. It puts the studio off the air when you... Oh!
Yeah, what happened, Mr. Horton?
Well, I don't know. Something pierced my finger.
Pierced your finger? Here, let me see. Well, what do you know about this?
What is that?
Hey, look here. A little pin sticking out of this button.
A little pin?
Yes, and that's not all. You see this stain on the lower half of this pin? If my guess is right, this pin's been dipped in poison.
But what does it mean?
It means that Van Doren didn't just die, but was murdered.
Murdered? But how?
Simple. When Van Doren went to switch the studio off the air, he stuck his finger on the pin and died immediately.
Incredible.
But that means anyone could have slipped in here and put that pin there.
Hey, you're wrong there, Mr. Horton. It means that one of you three put that pin there.
One of us?
Yes, Horton.
Who?
You, Mr. Taylor. You're under arrest for the murder of James Van Doren.
How did the inspector know it was Taylor who murdered Van Doren? We'll give you the solution in just a moment. And now for the solution.
I murdered Van Doren. Why, you're crazy.
Am I? You said you went out to check all the equipment. If someone else had put the pin on that button, you would have noticed it.
Well, one of the others could...
No, Taylor. It couldn't have been Raymond or Horton. Raymond's new in the radio business and knew nothing about the board or anything else about this studio. Remember, this was his first radio show. If it had been Horton, he wouldn't have accidentally stuck his finger on it just now. No, Taylor. You were the only possible one. Now, you better get ready to march. We're going to headquarters.
An abbreviated broadcast of 5-Minute Mysteries from June 24th, 1948, closing up our cases in this what turned out to be a detective-themed hour of collection curios. I hope you can be with us again for more unique broadcasts from radio's golden era. I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.